troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine. All the worries gonna leave my troubled mind. I've got a broken thing.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast. I am your co-host, Cameron English.
And I'm your other co-host, Kevin Falta, the professor and guy who is concerned that you know more about science.
And Kevin, can you guess what we're talking about today?
Oh, probably this coronavirus thing.
How'd you guess?
If my crystal ball.
How'd you guess? You're so smart. It must be that PhD.
Well, it... No, it's the thing on everyone's lips, right?
Right.
And literally.
Oh, all right. Silly jokes aside. Okay. Silly jokes aside, we've got a handful of important stories to go over with you guys. So first up, blood infusions from recovered COVID-19 patients can be used to protect at-risk people and maybe even treat people who are already infected. So we'll go over the evidence for how well this approach works. And did the virus really originate in a wet market in Wuhan, China? We're going to look at the data on this as well, but experts are surprisingly divided on this question. And yes, if you're young, you can still catch the virus. I'm still seeing posts go around on social media about how this is only affecting old people. So especially as we start to be able to address this, you know, pay attention to the risk that you're facing if you're young. And then finally, we need more experts to combat anti-science activism in the coming decade, or we risk some very serious public health consequences. So Kevin, let's get into this first story. This is Amy Maxman at Nature, and she's writing about how blood from coronavirus survivors might actually save lives. So what was your take on this story?
Well, this story is really great. Well, Amy, you know, always writes a good story. I always appreciate her work. But this came from Nature, as you mentioned. It was just a story in the beginning that really emphasizes a renaissance of what is a very old concept, that you could take the blood from somebody who experienced a certain illness and put that plasma, so leaving out the red blood cells and the white cells, just putting the plasma, which carries the antibodies, give those antibodies to someone who is either starting to be ill or perhaps on the front side of that to help combat the disease, the pathogen. And so this is a really old therapy. I think it was a couple named Baring and Kita Soto. This was back in like the 1890s. And they showed that you could use a prep of plasma to confer immunity on someone else against a disease. And this really got a lot of traction in the 1910s, 20s, 30s. And as it became more popularized as a therapy, then along came antibiotics. And so you had this modern medicine drug that now you didn't need to take blood and spin down blood to come up with a therapy. So that was the idea. And once antibiotics became, you know, widely available, this kind of thing fell out of favor. There still were a lot of immunoglobulin type treatments that were done for things like hepatitis B, rabies, varicella infections. There really just has been one that's been brought to market as a monoclonal antibody therapy against a disease, so infectious disease. So this was really kind of the idea, was that you could use the serum, which contained all the good stuff of someone who's already fought off the disease.
Now, this is really exciting stuff because we can use it right away. And we talked over the last couple of weeks about how a vaccine and a treatment might take a year and a half, and probably much more from what I'm hearing from vaccine experts now, is that the trials to make sure this is safe and effective are going to take a while. And so this could, and I think the phrase she uses, a stopgap, where you can give some treatment and some relief to people who are sick, even though we don't have these more advanced treatments available yet. So that's promising. Have you looked at any of the research that's been done on this yet, Kevin? I know the situation's evolving almost daily, but for this current pandemic that we're in, how likely is this to work?
Well, this is the, you know, just to kind of build on what you just mentioned, you know, that beauty of this is there's no R&D. Right. I mean, you take the plasma from survivors and put it into potential non-survivors and you see how they respond. And the research that's currently being done, you know, it's all been small studies and a lot of things in China like, you know, small studies of under 20 people, where they're given, and they call this convalescent plasma, right? It's someone who's already survived it. And they haven't shown a whole lot of efficacy, but they've been small studies on really sick people. So you take the more advanced cases, get the therapy, and you know, that's been a problem. So now the big push now is to actually do the hard studies. And there's been all kinds of interest in this from many different medical institutes, but some of them will be trying these therapies on people before they get the disease, on others that are just starting out with the disease, on others with more advanced cases. So they're going to do this at many different stages, and we'll get a massive amount of data, and probably inside the next, you know, 6 months.
Yep. And the coolest thing to me about this is it could really help us slowly start to get back on track. So get people back to work and get the people out socializing again who are really struggling with this. Now, for someone like me who's an introvert, this is just pure heaven. You know, I don't have to go anywhere. but for a lot of people, I know it's difficult, this isolation. And so I think what they're talking about now is developing these serological tests that can identify antibodies in people out in the general public. And then you can recruit these people to make plasma donations. And so through a process like this, we can slowly start to begin recovering. So I'm very excited about this news.
Yeah, I think that's been part of it. Is it may be part of the recovery plan. And even if you're able to, you know, decrease the duration or severity of disease to keep people off a ventilator, you know, then you're miles ahead. You know, if you can just keep people from becoming critical, and maybe this kind of therapy is just that kind of step. But the thing for me, I think about as a scientist, is the collateral things we will learn from a very intense investment, and a lot of this is sponsored research by the government now, what we will learn from basic science, from a very intense investment. I bet we have new therapies that come out against other diseases from this and from this kind of research. So, you know, crisis and opportunity, right?
Yeah. And just to irritate my libertarian friends, I think the FDA came out and they fast-tracked this. They basically said, you know, let's see if this works. And it wasn't made to go through all of these very, very rigorous drug trials that most of these things are going through, because they recognize the risk that we're facing in this pandemic. You know, there are literally millions of lives on the line. So this may be the best example of something that's going to get out to people quick, hopefully, assuming that that it works. And it seems like it does from the preliminary data we have.
Yeah, well, it's an investigational new drug is the way that they classify it. And, you know, this has been done before. It isn't like they just, you know, resurrected the technology from, you know, a long time ago. They've done some of this with Ebola. They did this with SARS.
Right.
With the first, you know, the first SARS. So these kinds of studies, but, you know, with those particular examples, not enough controls, too small a studies, you know, maybe it worked, maybe it didn't, but now we have a time to do it right. So pretty exciting.
Yep. So again, this is another story we're going to keep track of, I think, over the weeks as the situation evolves. But let's talk about where this pandemic actually came from, Kevin, because as you know, there's been wild theories. We've heard that, you know, it's actually 5G, or the government released it, or the Chinese government released it, or, you know, the Illuminati, whatever. But the two prevailing theories, the first one is that it came from this wet market in Wuhan, where someone ate a bat or presumably some other kind of exotic animal. But the latest one I've heard that's gained some credence is that it was accidentally released by a lab that's just outside of Wuhan, I believe. So,
well, yeah.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead. Yeah.
Well, that comes from a preprint that was on a preprint server by two Chinese scientists who said it was leaked from a lab in Wuhan. And there was very little data to support that. It were actually probably no data to support that. And the paper was withdrawn, probably with a little pressure from the Chinese government. But the U.S. and China are blaming each other for this now. And the Chinese are saying, hey, this was a U.S. plot. And there are people in the U.S. government, like, you know, Rush Limbaugh, he's kind of in the communications arm of the administration, I guess, who says that it's a Chinese bioweapon. And this kind of rhetoric really is dangerous, because it takes us away from getting to the root cause, which really is what we need to focus on in order to stave off future pandemics.
Now, I believe I read it was in Nature because they did like a full full genetic analysis of the virus, and they kind of basically recounted the situation thus far. And what I read in there was there isn't a ton of evidence that it escaped from a lab, but it's possible because at that lab in Wuhan, I think it was a pretty high level infectious disease laboratory, and they were studying coronaviruses there. So it wouldn't be unheard of for that to happen. What do you think about that?
Well, plausible, yes, but probably unlikely. The main reason is because that same paper, and it was in Nature Medicine, I think, maybe about 2 weeks ago, right. that paper laid out very nicely the genetic sequences or the protein sequences of the virus spike protein and the parts it uses for actual infection. And they align the ones with bat and human, and they're remarkably similar. And then this thing called a pangolin, which is a scaled mammal used in Chinese medicine, which I would love to know what that cures.
I don't.
Who knows? But the idea is that when you align all of these three most similar with SARS and some of the other human coronaviruses, you find that there are that they are extremely similar, almost identical, and that the human one has a big insert, a large insert, but a few more amino acids inserted into one of the domains of the virus that is one of its business domains. So it helps explain why this thing is a little different and why this thing is working the way it does. So it's very clear that it's a mutation that isn't likely manufactured. And the other side of this too is that if this was really something weaponized, they could have done a much better job. They know what residues or what parts of the protein cause enhanced infectivity or more virulence or whatever, and those were not changed in this particular virus.
Now, let me just play devil's advocate a little bit longer here. So this is from one of the virologists that CNN talked to for this article. And by the way, this is from CNN. It's Robert Kuznia and Drew Griffin writing at CNN Online. But some of the experts they talked to said that many of the early patients in China, in Wuhan more specifically, they had no direct exposure to the wet market. And so that would seem to challenge the prevailing view somewhat. And I think what they said is, well, there was probably some infected people that then went to the wet market and then started spreading it that way. So that's plausible. I can't say yes or no either way. Do you think that has any merit?
Well, it potentially. I think the trick is that they're trying to find a patient zero here. And I don't know that you can. They do know that patient zero in things like Ebola, that was someone who butchered a bat. And they know who the patient zero was in those cases. They know in other cases like from SARS and from MERS that there was zoonotic transfer. So jumping from animals to humans and through really weird intermediates, like SARS came through a civet and MERS came through a camel, which was really, knocked me over with a feather on that one. I mean, that's a weird one. But the basic idea is that zoonotic transfer or zoonotic spillover, this is something that could very easily happen in these Chinese wet markets, which are essentially open air slaughterhouses. So you can go there and pick out your pig or your pangolin or your whatever, and they'll slaughter it and gut it right there for you and send you home with pangolin fritters. It's they do that right on site. And so having this kind of exposure to things and everything's fair game, I should say. I've been in some of these markets in China where you have snakes and turtles and bats and scorpions. And I mean, you name it, anything that crawls and you can catch, they put on a stick and sell to you at the market. So if there was some opportunity for zoonotic transfer, this would be it.
Yeah, I think I'm just going to stick to Denny's after hearing you say that. One study I read, this was actually from 2007 when they were talking about the six other coronaviruses before this newest one was discovered. But the very last sentence in the abstract was very almost prophetic because they said, we know that these zoonotic viruses are all over the world and they jump from animals to humans very quickly. And especially in places like China, you have all these animals that are being eaten. So this is a ticking time bomb was the phrase they use. So, huh. I mean, that does seem most likely you know, this wet market theory, right? Because 13 years ago, we had people saying, hey, this is a problem, and no one was really paying attention, apparently.
Oh, sure. But was this from that Journal of Clinical Immunology, maybe? Or I can't remember now, because I've been reading so much in the last 2 weeks that I can't keep my paper straight. But there was a very prophetic review from year 2007 that described exactly what you're saying. And it was the abstract, and then the last lines of the paper itself said, just a matter of time. And so it was, it very much says, this is something that should be on our radar. And going forward, we need to have a much larger commitment to monitoring natural reservoirs and limiting human transfer. And it may be a question of no more eating bats.
Yeah, I mean, that doesn't seem like a really difficult commitment to me, but you know, I'm not the only one in the world, so
not a bridge too far.
Right. I wonder what they taste like, but I'm not curious enough to try it. You know, is it steak or chicken or is it Chipotle? Maybe.
I gave up bats for Lent, and by the time this is playing, I'll be back in, you know, bat consumption. But no, it is have you ever had battered bat? No, it seems strange to us, but when you're over in China and you go to these markets, and especially so many of their rural populations have some of the worst poverty I've seen in my life has been in China, in rural China. And people eat what you can get, what you can catch, what you can grab. And it's probably something that is a question not of preference, but of survival. And a lot of these natural reservoirs are going to have that happen.
Yep. Well, I don't know how to resolve that situation, because that's politics and economic. That's all kinds of issues that I don't want to get into. So we'll let someone smarter deal with that part. But yeah, it seems we need to figure out what we're going to do about eating bats. Anyway, so moving on. So I'm sure you've seen this too, Kevin. There was that one video floating around of that simple-minded teenager going down for spring break to Miami Beach. And he said something to the effect of, you know, if I get it, I get it. You know, I'm here to party. I've been planning this trip for 3 months. I'm not going to quit. You know, I think that was the end of March. But the story we're talking about, of course, is from the World Economic Forum. And they're warning young people that you can still get infected with this. So, you know, don't go party. Don't go to the beach. Don't go to the bar if there's any open, of course. But talk about this a little bit, because it's an important story.
Yeah, it's a really important one. And I remember when this all first started, maybe, you know, it really started ramping up in the U.S. back in March. NPR had a story on spring breakers, and it was very much one after another, like you just said. It's like, I'm only in college for 7 years. I got to make the most of every spring break, you know. And
Volta's class is shut down. Let's get a beer.
That's right. And so there's the basic idea is that when you look across what's happening right now, younger people are not necessarily showing up with this disease and the severity that it's happening in other segments of the population. And there's this weird kind of invincibility that's going on. And they really need younger folks to realize that you are not invincible, that this is going to be, could put you at very high risk, could kill you, and even worse, could be something that you then pass on to the old folks at home. And so that's really the message that's coming from the WHO, from Stephen Fauci, from everybody along the chain here.
Right, right. And I think that last point you made is probably the most important, because according to and this is based on a CDC study that was released at the end of March, but what they found is that if you're under 55, the case fatality rate is less than 1%. So that's really good news. But as you said, you know, maybe you pick up this virus and your immune system's strong enough to fight it off, but you're still technically carrying it. And so you could infect someone who's at higher risk, like a grandparent or something, you know? So maybe this is just a matter of thinking beyond your own interest and thinking about your role in your larger community, perhaps.
Yeah, that's something that maybe we don't see so much of in different parts of the population, right? That's kind of and I shouldn't say that too much, because I know that in younger folks, that tends to be maybe a little more common. But I think right now, you know, as a professor who works with college students, I think they're probably the most sensitive to others' plights than I've seen in previous decades. Like, you know, especially back when I was in school, it was, you know, everyone for themselves, even if you got to step on somebody else. It was like the Alex Keaton, you know, days when that was the biggest influence. I think the kids now are much more aware of others and the kids, that young adults today, college students today, that those age brackets, I know I sound horrible, are much more sensitive to this. And I do think heed the warnings in general, but of course there's always, you know, some knuckleheads out there who feel it's their right to party.
Well, I mean, if you got to do jello shots, you got to do jello shots, Kevin. Why don't you just be reasonable here?
Well, as long as they're over 60% ethanol, they maintain
science joke.
No, they maintain antimicrobial power, right?
Right.
Right.
See, so you're helping your health and you're having fun.
well, there are some interesting edges on this that I thought I'd just throw out there, because there's other data. You know, other folks have suggested the hypothesis that our younger people today just genetically selected to not get the virus, so that maybe they have a more natural barrier, at least that's being expressed in their earlier years. And there's been a lot of investigation into these things now that we can do genomics on such a large scale, meaning looking at all the DNA sequence of somebody's makeup and compare that against other people. And there's an investigator at Rockefeller, Jean-Laurent Casanova. And the idea there is that is susceptibility to viral infection somehow genetic, and that genes expressed when you're younger may protect you. And he's shown that there are mutations in influenza, tuberculosis. There are mutations in people that protect them from things like influenza or tuberculosis, and that those mutations tend to happen higher in younger populations. And so is this something where we've been selecting? And I can't see how that can happen so fast as a geneticist. But when you take those mutations and you put them in mice, the mice don't get tuberculosis or influenza at the same rate. So there is something to it, and maybe something that can be applied to coronavirus as well.
Yeah, it's a definite possibility. And again, it's frustrating as a journalist, because I want answers now so I can write about it, you know, but the reality is you go with the cards that you're dealt, and you have to figure things out as time goes on. So I guess we'll just kind of have to shrug our shoulders at this point, because there's no definitive answer on that.
Yeah, there's nothing definitive, but again, I think this is the time when we're going to see a rain of funding into this kind of thing, not just coronavirus, SARS-CoV-2, the one that's causing COVID-19, but also just the phenomenology of zoonotic transfer, natural immunity, different segments of the population that may have immunity. I mean, imagine if you could get all of those folks to go staff the hospitals, you know, or, you know, aid in the national core of cleanup or whatever. This would be a really cool thing to know, you know, if you had some sort of natural immunity to the pathogen that's killing others. So lots of interesting thoughts.
Yeah. And just a question, a follow-up, but since you said that, would these serological tests they're developing, would they be able to detect people like that? Like if you have some kind of a genetic protection against this, would you have antibodies in your system that would show you as immune to this?
Well, I don't know that you would have antibodies. I think what it would say is you have some other genetic factor that gives you immunity. So in other words, maybe your cells, like when we talked about HIV a few weeks ago, your cells don't have the ability to bind to the virus. So the virus can't recognize your cell as a target. And those could be easily done with an even more simple DNA test. And I think, well, the antibody tests are pretty easy, but very simple DNA test like PCR, the one they use to link, you know, a criminal to a cigarette butt in a crime scene,
right.
They could use to tell, you know, you may be a resistant. It's kind of Gattaca, but it's cool.
Right. And you're talking about polymerase chain reaction, right? Just for people that don't know that abbreviation.
That's right. Just the technique that we use in the laboratory to amplify known segments of DNA. So if you know there's a difference between two people, you can amplify that little region and find ways to tell who has it and who doesn't.
Right. Okay. Well, let's move on to this final story then. And this one kind of struck home for me just because of, and you too, I'm sure, since we're both kind of in the science communication world. But this is called Combating Anti-Science, Are We Preparing for the 2020s by Peter J. Hotez. And this was in PLOS Biology. So Kevin, I mean, again, this is right in your wheelhouse. So what did you take away from this article after reading it?
Well, I love Peter Hotez. Okay, so he's a physician at Baylor School of Medicine and a tremendous vaccine advocate. And he's a guy who his family's been threatened. He's been hassled. People have shown up at conferences where he's speaking to protest. You know, this dude has gotten a fulta share of hassle, and my heart goes out to him. But I love that he has really spoken out about this in really a way where he didn't mince words. And he throws around the idea of anti-science. First word in the article is anti-science. And a lot of people object to that. I think he reinforces it very well because he says that these are organized and funded organizations that their job is to reject science and to make sure that the scientists are disqualified or hassled or threatened or whatever, or at least, you know, their reputations assaulted. And he really was very clear that this could be a tremendous problem going forward. As you know, as we have to win public opinion if you're going to have any kind of scientific change take place. So that was his central thesis.
And one point I think that we should stress is that this has real implications for public health. And this is a quote from the article as well. He says, the decline in vaccinations is the result of several factors, but in the U.S. and many European nations, it's strongly linked to a strengthened, empowered, and emboldened anti-vaccine movement. And so I get the impression from a lot of people who are political commentators, and maybe they lean more conservative, or maybe they're liberal as well, but they're just skeptical of big corporations. And they kind of look at this and they go, hey man, you know, back off my health freedom. Don't tell me what to do, kind of a thing. But I don't think they understand that, you know, people actually die when you tell them not to get vaccines. It's very serious. So what's your take on that? I think that's a really important point to emphasize.
It's huge. And we did the experiment, right? I mean, people said, well, vaccines aren't necessary. Well, they stopped doing them and people got sick. It was a beautiful experiment that people did on their own kids, you know, and that way not so beautiful, but they basically did the experiment. And the problem is that when you're looking at something like human papillomavirus, where we have a vaccine that can solve it, and parents aren't administering this to sexually active children, you know, whether it's, you know, which happens, right? When you're 13 through 19, you know, some people are active in those windows. Pizza Face Fulton, not so much back then, but you know, some people are out getting the job done at those ages, and you know, and they are spreading what can be a life-threatening virus that can have long-term health implications for both females and males. Males with higher instances of penile cancers, females with cervical cancer, other cancers of the head and neck that eventually can happen from these infections. So this one has real implications of not implementing the vaccine.
Yeah. And by the way, just so people think we're, you know, we're putting our money where our mouth is, I actually got the HPV many years ago now because I was still in my early 20s and I've only grown one extra arm. So I think everyone should just stop with the whining because it doesn't do anything that serious.
Well, you got the HPV or the HPV in vaccine?
Yeah. Sorry, if I didn't say vaccine, let me back up.
Yeah, your Tinder window will be sliding shut.
Yeah, yeah, my wife wouldn't be thrilled either.
Oh, yeah, I got. Yeah, okay.
Let me back up. I got the vaccine because it works for men too, in the sense that you can, as you just said, you can contract the disease from a sexual partner. So I've gotten the vaccine, and of course it's only one person, but what my experience matches the research that's been done, which says that this doesn't have any negative side effects. And they've done, right, they did the FDA clinical trials, but there's been other research subsequently, and no one's found that this, I don't even know what they're trying to link this to, but it doesn't, you know, there's been no evidence that it causes any issues.
No, that's right. And the epidemiological data is coming out now that it's been something being administered for more than, you know, a decade and a half now. And you can see very strong suppression of HPV in different populations. And I think that's a testament to how well this can work. And it shows the danger of the anti-vax community. It's my silver lining of this COVID crisis that maybe when a vaccine comes out for this, that will be the thing that really puts this to bed.
Yeah, possibly. I don't think you'll ever convince them, but I think, as you've said before, you're trying to mind the silent observer. So after this thing passes, hopefully, God willing, I think the general public will be a little more skeptical of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and McCarthy. What's her first name? I don't, who cares?
Jennifer.
Yeah. Yeah.
I used to tutor her sister.
Did you really?
Yeah. I used to tutor her sister. She was an athlete at the university where I was a graduate student, and I'd make extra money doing tutoring for athletes. And she was one of them. So how about that?
Yeah. Maybe you should have tutored her as well, because then we could have stopped.
Tell your sister. No, her sister. Yeah, that was a very interesting time. But you know, back to what Hotez says, and who is awesome, and I love that he's become a relatively public figure on CNN and a go-to correspondence for these issues. But he says the flip side of this. You know, it's not just about combating or ending the pseudoscience. It's about scientists getting into the public view. And he talks about Bill Nye and Neil deGrasse Tyson. He goes, okay, well, here's two guys who aren't necessarily, you know, writing grant proposals and beating themselves up to get papers published and, you know, mentoring students. What people need to do is see what real scientists do. And those scientists, and I'll just pull a line out of his article here, says, you know, meaning scientists that are in the mix, meaning active in their fields, publishing papers, writing grants, and speaking at scientific meetings, and are simultaneously comfortable with engaging the public and who are versatile in modern tools of written and oral communication. And I think we're starting to see those changes with SciComm. The sad part is, you know, so let me tell you the good part. I think a lot of really progressive universities are digging into this, and that you're going to see the leading universities, if they haven't already, establishing aggressive programs in science communication that merge communication, different aspects of biology or science in general, and journalism. I think that's happening. But at the same time, you have other universities that shall remain nameless that say to their faculty, you know, shut up. You know, this is not your job to be communicating with the public. You know, you can't do this. And there's a number of universities, especially through, you know, the FOIA things over the last few years, that have told their researchers, hey, get your head down and don't talk about this. And I think it's exactly the opposite of what we need to be doing as scientists.
Yeah. And another point, I don't know if he directly makes this point in the article, but one thing that really stuck out to me is that as academics and science communicators like me, to a smaller extent, we're going up against people that all they do is PR, basically. So a lot of these activist groups like Environmental Working Group or US Right to Know or so on and so forth, all these people do is write press releases and go on podcasts and write op-eds and go on TV. You know, they don't have to do science. As you said, they're not writing grant proposals. They're not doing research. So they've been able to really hone their skills in terms of convincing people that there's a problem. And then their side of the story is very easy to tell, because what they're doing is they're going, chemical X is causing cancer, or GMOs are going to make you sterile, or whatever, you know, whatever the boogeyman of the day is. That's all they do is talk about that. And so for some, I mean, you're an exception, Kevin, because you're really good at this. But for an academic, you're just not trained to go up against somebody who has all of those those tools already in their tool bag, ready for a debate. You know what I mean? So, sure. So we need people to catch up in this respect.
Yeah. So you really frame the problem well. It's academics who don't know how to do it. And when they do try, first, they don't want to try. You know, we select for, again, people who are introverts and folks who like to, the top science universities have selected for faculty that are not excited about getting involved at the public interface. You know, you want your lab, you want your, you know, writing grants, maybe mentoring students. And that's a full-time job and a half right there. And then to step out, step out in the public conversation where you're not going to get credit for it. You don't get a gold star. You get hassled. Your university gets hassled. There's very little upside for the individual to do this. The good news is there's a lot more of us than there are of them. And if scientists were stepping into these conversations, maybe not as a full-time or even a quarter-time or a 10% time activity, but just now and then commenting on Twitter or sharing a story on Facebook, you know, I think we could turn this thing around. So we have to realize Hotez's dream here, but it needs to happen in baby steps with many individuals, each carrying a little bit of that water.
Yep, absolutely. And one thing that I think will make this easier, and people tend to downplay this part of it, is that if you can just put a human face on this mass of unknown academics, these people that are working at the lab bench, and you can just say, hey, my name's Steve and I'm a biologist and I have a wife and I have kids and, you know, here's what I do. If you can just get someone to get out and do that, even if they're not great public speakers, if you can just show their human side, I think that might alleviate a lot of this problem. What's your take, Kevin?
Well, that's what the research shows. The research shows that it is all about trust and not about data. And rather than scientists who like to come out and talk about data and figures and, you know, error bars and all that good stuff, rather than that, which is what I used to do, now it's about building trust. It's about saying, hey, I got a family. I worry about what my kids eat, and I wouldn't feed them something that was dangerous. You know, good example, my wife has a farm, and, you know, we were out on a small farm, and people at the farmer's markets, you know, do you spray anything? And we say, well, absolutely, we got to control the pests, but we're not going to spray anything that is going to harm us or our kids, or, you know, our animals or whatever, because you know, anything, and we go out and we eat stuff right out of the ground, right off the plant. You know, we're not washing it even often, you know. But so the point is that once they know that you do this and that it's what your common practice is and that you share the same interests, then they become very accepting of the science around it.
Yeah, well, I guess overall, I'd say this is an encouraging story then, because you have sort of a blueprint that he's providing. And he makes this point too. He says, over the course of 2 or 3 decades, I basically went into the lion's den and got chewed up, and I made mistakes on live TV, and I bungled my words on a radio interview. And then finally, through this process of very painful education, I learned how to do this professionally. And so by incentivizing researchers to do this as part of their graduate work, they're going to get better at it faster, which is going to make this an easier problem to tackle.
Yeah. And we do that. We're actively training students in science communication. I taught a seminar course on it this last semester, and students did presentations that'll be online, as well as wrote articles that may end up in Genetic Literacy Project. So that's a really good thing. And the other big part of this is that we come out of a post-COVID world. Is there a possibility that we may be in a climate that is less amenable for misinformation and disinformation? And could we even have a presidential office of disinformation? You know, could we actually have a scientist legal defense fund, or even better, a scientist legal offense fund? You know, this is kind of my dream and where I would like to see things go, because people will step into the conversation if they know they will be protected from the harassment.
Yeah, well, I don't even know what that would look like. It's an interesting concept, though. So would you have like an expert panel of people whose job it is to just find nonsense out there on the internet and put out information to counter it? Or is that what you're talking about?
Well, I was thinking just me. Like maybe I'd get an office and I could, you know, and I could just point out, hey, you know, and then have a team of folks to kind of, no, seriously, I think it would be the kind of thing where we do need to have a trust in maybe, you know, AAAS or national academies, that the syntheses they already do, which very high level syntheses on issues like climate change, on issues like vaccination, make those bigger, make them more publicly accessible, make them something that the government celebrates and puts public service announcements together on. You know, that's the kind of stuff that we need to do to burst the bubble. And I think that's where we are.
Yeah. Well, just in closing, one thing I think that might help, again, just as an outside observer, is trying to divorce this issue from politics on either side of the aisle. And I see this all the time, is you have people on the right and people on the left who will say, you know, the people that I disagree with hate science. And then they give the example of climate change, or they give the example of pollution or tobacco or whatever. And so I think that actually polarizes this issue even more, is if you say, you know, we're the good guys and the bad guys are over there and they don't like science. And then, you know, the people that you're trying to convince are the people you're now calling the bad guys. And so I, you know, as much as we can, as much as possible, I think we need to get away from that polarization, because it's not helping, in my opinion, at least.
No, you're right. You're exactly right. When you politicize it, you now put it into kind of arbitrary camps that have to reinforce the idea. And Dan Kahan has done a lot of beautiful work on this at Yale, where he talks about these trusted communities. The cultural cognition is what he refers to it as, at culturalcognition.org, where, you know, people will start to take on all of the elements of a given doctrine, you know, whether it's right or left or whatever, and shun the elements that their side doesn't subscribe to. And we have to get away from that. And I think it goes back to the idea that we need more people trained in scientific thinking and people willing to say, you know, hey, you know, I was wrong. I got that wrong. You know, I'm glad I got it right. And if you're willing to do that, then you see things move forward. And every time I see the president speak about this, I cringe, because he could walk away from this with a very, very strong, well, I should say a stronger perception. If he just said, look, this was a tough one to call and I screwed up. And, you know, now we're doing everything we can to get it right. But he can't do that. And folks who did screw up, like Dr. Drew, they've eaten a lot of crow for this, and say, you know, hey, it was very difficult. I was going with the numbers I had and the training I had, and here's the call I made. And I was wrong. And next time we'll get it right. And I think that's what we need more of, is more people willing to drop the side, drop their allegiances, that kind of noise, and simply be able to look at the data, talk to other people about the data, talk to experts about the data, and come up with a better synthesis. And that's how we change it.
Yep. Powerful stuff as always, Kevin. You got these little fortune cookie nuggets of wisdom that I like to end the podcast with. So thanks for that. Another good one.
Oh, thanks. I should, maybe I may have another career in writing science fortune cookies.
I'd buy them. Just let me know when they're available. So tell people about your Facebook science education project that you got going on.
Well, yeah. Confucius says your hypothesis sucks. No. So right now I've been doing some stuff on Facebook. I was trying to do a different science lesson every day at 11 o'clock, but then all of a sudden people realized you could get work done by Zoom. And I have just been pounded with conference calls that last way too long. So I've had to step away from that a bit, but I'm going to try to do one or two a week. So those will be available on my personal Facebook page at KM Folta, and watch Twitter. And those are always very widely distributed there. And of course, the Talking Biotech podcast every Saturday is every week is kind of a gem. So hope you listen.
Yeah, well, the last one with Jeffrey Cabot was really good and relevant given the situation we find ourselves in. So, yeah, check out the podcast. What's your handle on Twitter, Kevin?
At Kevin Folta, which is KevinFolta. And that's it. Active very much on Twitter, and really appreciate more people tuning in, especially to the science education stuff. That's really important.
Absolutely. Well, you can get the podcast at geneticliteracyproject.org and at Genetic Literacy on Twitter. And I'm at Cam J. English. and we will see you guys next week. Thanks so much.